Hey, this is Ash Hamilton with Horror Fix. I'm with Jim Chandler tonight, also from HorrorFix.com, and we are Night Terrors Radio. We got a great show lined up. I'm actually really excited about tonight, and that's not bullshit.
That's right.
I bullshitted about other shows.
But not this one.
I won't say specifically who I wasn't exactly all that excited about, but I'm really excited about tonight. Right. I'm undermining all the other shows, unfortunately. Like, the fourth wall, it's unraveling. Totally unraveling. Not only do I love horror, by the way, but I am a huge fan of cryptids. I am a huge fan of the paranormal. Even though, strangely enough, those two are fairly separate. And you get people on both sides that sort of, you know, vehemently hate the other side. It's weird.
Really?
It's like it's a civil war of beliefs. It's very strange. But for me, I'm sort of all-inclusive. Like, I like all of it. I think all of it is interesting, not only from a perspective of the reality of it, or potential reality of it, but also the entertainment value of it as well. And speaking of entertainment value, we have Seth Breedlove. He is a filmmaker who specializes at this point in cryptid filmmaking. He's also the man behind Small Town Monsters, which I gotta say, I love the Small Town Monsters documentaries. It's the fact that we're getting consistently good documentaries on the subject, and I'm talking about documentaries with value, with production value, consistently good films based on some subjects that I never really thought we'd get some really good documentaries about, specifically like the Michigan Dog Man, the Bray Road Monster. So this is stuff that I'm really happy to talk about tonight. So welcome, Seth, and thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight talking about all things sort of hairy with large teeth.
Yeah, that
it sounds like a lonely Italian man from the Bronx, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, it does. I was curious where that sentence was.
I just described half my audience.
But yeah, thanks for having me. It's always cool to come on and talk the paranormal and cryptids. And like you said, like, there really is this bizarre the two camps, like, they rarely meet, and we just really delved into that a little bit and on the Trail of Bigfoot, actually. But like the paranormal camp and the flesh and blood, like, cryptid camp, people get like set in their little belief system, and that's where they're going to hang out. And there is like a weird intercontinental war going on between those two camps, it seems like.
In my mind, it's sort of like Revenge of the Nerds-esque, too. Like, I want to think that it's not just like believers or non-believers or sects of believers. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to think that they're like fraternities.
Really? It's not far off. It's not far off. Like, people really, like, they not only, it's funny because, like, it's both sides too. You know, you could almost see like the paranormal camp being like, just kind of like, who cares, and like focusing on their you know, Bigfoot coming out of portals or like UFOs or whatever. But instead, it really, like, it runs both ways. Like, the flesh and blood people are constantly at war with the paranormal and mocking the paranormal people, and the paranormal people are irate that the flesh and blood people don't understand that Bigfoot is an alien, or that, you know, the Jersey Devil came out of a portal in the sky or whatever. So it's a very bizarre, very fractured community. And what's really weird too about like the paranormal world is, like, you can boil down the various interests into their own camps. So you've got like your Bigfooters, but they don't necessarily, like, your typical Bigfooter doesn't necessarily, it's not someone that might be into like other cryptids or UFOs or whatever. It's not always, you know, like, most Bigfooters that I know are just into Bigfoot and that's their thing. But the, you know, like, some of these other subjects like UFOs, like, those people don't really mix with Bigfoot people. And it's comical. At some point, someone needs to do a very in-depth documentary about that, just about like that side of this strange little community that I'm a part of.
I would most certainly watch it.
I would.
I remember a few years ago, and I might want to say a few years ago, whenever I say this dates me horribly, because it'll end up being like 20 years ago. In my mind, it's three.
Right.
Three to six. Mm-hmm. It's usually like 12 to 18.
That's because we're perpetually 13, though.
Well, of course, yeah, yeah. There was a documentary that was more of a mockumentary about a UFO enthusiast who spent this week in Roswell.
Oh, yeah.
But it was an interesting depiction of the people that actually go to the festivals in Roswell. And I'm one of those guys. I mean, I spent my honeymoon in Roswell. So,
nice.
You know, I know the appeal. I know the attraction. I also know that, for me, there's a certain kitsch value.
Mm-hmm.
Just in the fact that I think we're losing these pieces of Americana, and I think that a lot of this sort of like Tex-Mex Americana sort of stuff sort of sits comfortably in the same seats as some of these cryptid researchers and people sure. with the very sort of colorful personalities in the world of the paranormal. But yeah, it's really interesting that we start talking about stuff like camps and talking about the believers and non-believers of just certain areas. And then I've seen the same thing, Seth, that a lot of like Bigfooters, that's just like they are Bigfooters.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And like I said, that's a very specific genre of this subject matter that people are that I know anyway, who are into that, who are really into it, who like actively go out and investigate and research. They don't really mix with the other stuff. Like they're not out looking for UFOs or CHAMP. I mean, I know people who cross genres, but for the most part, like most of the really active investigators, that's their thing. Like Bigfoot is their world, and they don't bother with, you know, they don't mix with the others. And I don't know if that's because they're so actively involved in the investigative side of things that they feel like they don't have time for the other stuff, or if that's just it, like that's where their interest lies. I know Bigfoot is interesting because for a lot of people, they are not open to something like ghosts or, you know, some of the more bizarre cryptids, but they're open to Bigfoot, I guess, to that subject because there might be like a more believable sort of biological reality to it, so they can buy into it a little easier, and you know, they have an easier time of like explaining to their wife that they're going out to look for like an undiscovered ape than I'm going out to look for like chupacabra or something.
Right. Yeah. A person that we got to know quite well over the last oh geez, now it's been like over 15 years. Yeah, I'm definitely old. Is Adam Davies, who was searching for the Sumatran sort of missing link there.
Yeah,
and you know, he was one of those guys who sort of came out of the starting gate like, you know, this could be an endangered animal, and I'd like to find out if it's there, and if so, you know, how do you protect it? And then he just went apeshit crazy. Which is great, but I love Adam. Like, I love the fact that he decided to embrace so many different aspects of cryptids and cryptozoology, because for the longest time, he was just Orang Pendek. He was the guy. He was the Orang Pendek guy. And then, you know, he ended up investigating the Mongolian death worm for, you know, monster hunters and stuff. And
yeah.
Adam's just a very larger-than-life guy.
See, I mean, that's how I am. I started out being super into UFOs and Bigfoot, and then the scope of everything is kind of broadened, and there really isn't a limit to like what I can find myself contemplating making movies about. Like, it's like we made that Invasion on Chestnut Ridge movie, and I mean that movie has a little bit of everything, including like there was a point in the making of that movie where we had to I cut us off at what was it, iridescent caterpillars. I was like, you know what, like I think we've put enough in this movie. We probably need to pull back on the iridescent caterpillars because I think people are going to check out at that point. But like I could see myself doing a movie about almost anything if I thought there was like an audience that would actually watch it, because like all this stuff fascinates me, and I think there's ways to approach it with each subject we're covering. Like there's different ways to approach the stuff, you know, that might, you know, sort of draw in people who otherwise might not have been interested in it. Like Bray Road's actually a good example of that, because the idea with that was to make this movie that was kind of like this Hammer. It started out like envisioned as like a Hammer homage, like a homage to like old Hammer movies, and it became something else completely in the actual making of it. Like at this point, the only really Hammer moments to that movie are the opening and closing with the old book on the table and stuff like that. Kind of reminds me of something out of a Hammer movie, but the movie actually became much more modern and like almost like found footage style and stuff like that. But there's like we when we approach these like super bizarre subjects, we try to anchor it with something that the audience, a general sort of audience, will, you know, be able to tap into and be like, oh, okay, so this is kind of like that thing that I understand. So now I can, you know, I've got that to cling to as I'm being taken down the rabbit hole of satanic werewolf dog people running around North America.
You know, and I had talked to Linda Godfrey years ago, especially when there was the sort of initial interest in this. And at that point, there wasn't a lot of talk or speculation about the black magic sort of angle or the supernatural angle. It was a little more on the cryptid side, but I love the fact that the story has opened up in its end of itself to where the mythology is so vast now, and it was such sort of a niche cryptid subject years ago. About when did that really start to happen, when we started to have those different aspects, especially the idea of like sorcery and black magic?
Well, that was a happy accident as far as like how we got into it in our movie. The fact was, like, we were going for much more of like a sort of flesh and blood, you know, like there's the people are seeing a real werewolf in America. And then, you know, during the interview, there were different things that kept coming up throughout the course of making the Bray Road Beast that were kind of bizarre and pushing the story in really unusual directions. One of them was that, the St. Coletta's story, which was there's this like mental institution in Jefferson County, which is above Walworth County, where the Bray Road Beast was seen, and or the Beast of Bray Road was seen. I call it the Bray Road Beast just because I made a movie called that. but I mean, Beast of Bray Road is what everyone knows.
I like
it
the
as,
consistency,
so.
Though, Seth. I appreciate.
Yeah. Well, it comes from like 2 years now of consistently trying to explain to people that we did not make an adaptation of Linda's book.
Right.
So I just am constantly saying it over and over. But yeah, like while we were making the movie, we went out to St. Coletta's, and in the 1930s, this night watchman had seen what he claimed was a werewolf type creature. At this old, essentially like a home for mentally disabled people, and he had encountered this thing. It had approached him. It was saying the word Gadara over and over. And while we were there, we actually went to St. Coletta's and found it to be this a giant, like enormous. It's almost like a college campus sized, old school, very Art Deco style insane asylum. Like it would be the absolute perfect setting for
I'm sold.
Movie. Yeah. And we found some weird stories while we were there, like the fact that there had been an exorcism on the grounds 2 weeks prior to this night watchman's wow. sighting, and that the priest that had performed the exorcism felt like he was being followed around by whatever he had exorcised. So there were some like weird little hints that something was, you know, sinister going on beyond just like a werewolf story. And then like we got to John Frederickson's interview, and John was the animal control officer for Walworth County, which like this was going to be our really like our way of really selling the story. You've got this government official, you know, Walworth County's the guy that took all the initial werewolf stories that came in around the same time as the Beast of Bray Road sightings. And I was super excited about it. And halfway through the interview, one of my crew members, because we do this like during interviews, after I've gone through most of my initial questions, I'll just be like, anybody else want to ask anything? Mm-hmm. And the guy that actually does the music for my movies, Brandon, he like chimed in and was like, hey, can you talk about like the occult stuff that was going on in Walworth County at the time? And then that just like all of a sudden blew up into, you know, like really that interview, that section of John's interview, influenced our entire direction going forward. Like as far as like how the movie was edited, really pushing the more like horror vibe to that movie.
Yeah.
And then it really influenced everything we did after that. Even like the marketing of the movie completely changed. But yeah, like that is not something that I had seen really focused on in any of the other you know, movies or television shows focused on Dogman and, you know, like the werewolf mythology and that kind of stuff. It was much more like, especially some of the TV shows I had seen was trying to make it out that there was some sort of like species of dog people roaming around North America. And I know a lot of people believe that. I personally don't think it makes any sense, like biologically, how would that work? But yeah, like that angle to it was what actually got me invested in that story, like the really bizarre, like occult type stuff and really getting to go down that road of, you know, like a sinister sort of occult activity taking place around Walworth County. But then that also kind of feeds into when we went into the chapter on werewolf lore, and you can see that there's some similarities between what was going on in Elkhorn and what was going on, you know, over with like the Beast of Javadon in the United Kingdom and Europe and all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of that as far as like roads and like different angles to the story that we could cover. The Bray Road Beast is one where we could easily make like a sequel, mm-hmm. and still not scratch the surface. Like that first movie was great as far as like a door opener, but there's much more we can do with that story at some point.
As a person who's followed these stories for now upwards of 15 years, I was both delighted and I was surprised at the fact that you were able to add that component to it, because I wasn't expecting it. You know, I thought it was going to center mostly on the cryptid angle, but yeah. I agree with you in the sense that it opened up to a point where when you watch the documentary, you're like, there's a deeper story here. This is a layer. You know,
yeah, no, it's like peeling back an onion or something, because there's just like one thing after the next. And that's why the movie was told with like chapters, and I think there's like 11 or 12 chapters to it, which I don't know that I've seen that in a movie. Within the context of our film, it works because it opens with the book opening, you know, so you kind of know you're being taken through a book. But there were so many things to cover, and like I said, like we didn't really, not in depth anyway, we didn't really get into the Native American angle, mostly because we didn't have someone to speak directly about the Native American beliefs in the area. Linda did a little bit, and then Ricky is a Native American, and he has had some insight there. But like, we barely scratched the surface with that, and there's just so much we can do, you know, just with the mythology of Dogman and werewolf lore. Because I mean, that we were talking about the different camps. Something I've noticed since we made that movie is people who are super into the Dogman phenomenon do not like when people refer to it as werewolf or like the werewolf lore. They somehow get offended, like that's like insulting to the Dogman or something. So, but I mean, obviously there's direct correlation between those two subjects. So yeah, there's so much to that I hope we can go back to. I mean, we didn't even the thing that bugs me about that movie compared to our others is we didn't get to interview any of the original witnesses. And you know, like we had like three interviews cancel while we were making that movie. And the way our movies are made, because of the budgets and because of how we're you know, like the amount of time allotted to us, we basically have 5 days to make a movie in Elkhorn. Oh my God. And we lost three of our interviews while we were there. And it's interesting too, because I've been in touch with like Lori Andreese, who was one of the very first sightings of the Beast of Bray Road. In fact, she messaged me this morning to tell me she had watched the movie last night and loved it. So, but like if we want to, like I'm hoping at some point we can go back and get some of those original witness interviews, Doris Gibson, like that kind of thing, and really do a more expanded look at the Beast of Bray Road subject, because there's a ton to do with that particular story.
Well, I'm definitely on board, not just because of my personal interest, but as far as documentaries tackling subject matter like that, it really came across as something that we've never really seen before, both with the occult angle and just the fact that when you're sort of talking about it off the cuff, it's hard for it not to sound silly, like admittedly.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But when you get into your documentary, you sort of abandon the silliness pretty quickly. And then you're looking at the earnestness of the people that are there. the people that you've talked to, and it just becomes this other thing entirely, and it becomes so quickly and so believably that really what you're looking at is you're looking at all the possible angles, and you're suspending disbelief very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, like all of our movies kind of have that same approach, going all the way back to Minerva Monster, and I think most people, like a general audience, probably has that kind of like, "Are you serious right now?" like reaction to any of these subjects, you know. But I've always felt like if you take it seriously and you present it seriously and you allow the original witnesses and you allow those people that are tied to these stories to tell the story, I think you can draw in any audience because the stories are super fascinating, whether you believe there's like a factual reality to it or not. And that's leaving out entirely the idea of small town monsters as like historical documents, you know, like movies that are capturing these witnesses stories for posterity for the future. Like just as entertainment, I think it's super, appealing to any audience because there's the horror angle and like the scary story aspect of it, but it's just the people themselves tend to be believable and likable. Like there aren't many witnesses that we've interviewed that I look back on and say, well, they come across ridiculous or like they, you know, they don't come across believably. For the most part, like the people we've interviewed are very believable, earnest people, you know, like no matter how ludicrous their story might seem on the surface, you know, like the absolute perfect example is Ed and Fred May, who were in the Flatwoods Monster movie we made, because the, you know, like the Flatwoods Monster is the most ridiculous thing if you hear about it, because it's like this 13-foot tall green monster with an Ace of Spades cloak on it, yeah. You know, it smells, it's got like laser eyes, it's up on this hill in this tiny town in West Virginia, so naturally everyone must have been high on drugs or smoking or you know, like drinking moonshine or something.
Yeah.
And then you meet these guys who were kids at the time when everything happened, and their version of the story is something completely different from what it's become, and instantly they're much more believable. They've clung to the story. They've stuck to their story since they were 5 and 7 years old, respectively, and they're now in their, you know, 70s because this happened in 1952. And all of a sudden, like, you can put them on camera and let them just tell their story to an audience, and our visuals are there simply to heighten what they're saying, you know, to hopefully help an audience visualize, you know, the reality of what they're claiming happened to them. So, I mean, to me, all these subjects are really fascinating, and you can make any bizarre topic, you know, something that an audience can tap into, as long as you come at it with the right approach, which is a tightrope to walk, because, you know, like you want to be entertaining, right? Like that's why we make movies, but you also want to make sure that you're not treating the witnesses and their stories like disrespectfully, as weird as that might seem. Like you don't want them, the last thing we've ever wanted to do is to like disrespect a witness who came to us and trusted us to tell their story.
And most of the witnesses too aren't coming to you at an angle where they're wanting to convert you to their system of thought. You know,
no, I mean, most of them we have to convince, you know, like to even be on camera. I can't. There's one case where someone approached me, where someone came to me and was like, "I want to be in this." It's always I have to go to them and then convince them to be a part of it.
Yeah, and this is a huge difference that I find strangely between your approach to documentary filmmaking and a lot of the documentaries that we get on the UFO subject, for example. There's always this ever lingering presence when it comes to UFO documentaries where it's always about pushing the belief agenda, you know, whether it's a series or whether it's a film. And that's one thing that's always sort of unnerved me about UFO documentaries is the fact that, in my opinion, there's an overwhelming amount of evidence that something has happened or something continues to happen. That I wish they would take that approach where it's more telling the stories. It's more of an approach of letting the witnesses come forward and not convince you, but just tell the stories so that you're adding to the mythology.
That's super fascinating that you bring that up, because like over the weekend, We did the premiere for On the Trail of Bigfoot at this huge theater here in Canton, Ohio. And like 500 people came out and we had like a great time. But like the most consistent thing we were hearing is that it was unlike any other Bigfoot documentary that these people had seen. And they were like, I don't know what it is that set it apart. And then that started this whole discussion between some of the crew and myself. And like we decided like the biggest thing, and this is consciously or unconsciously, subconsciously, not unconsciously. We're not unconsciously making movies, although some people might argue that. But
I've met a few filmmakers who might actually fall into that category.
there's no agenda. Like I don't care if an audience watches any of my stuff and comes away believing, you know, in Dogman or Bigfoot or UFOs or whatever. So we're not pushing that agenda of either belief or debunkment. Debunkment? Is that a thing? Debunking.
It is now.
There's no interest in pushing one particular opinion on the subject. It really just comes down to letting, you know, the people that are a part of the story tell their story. Even on the Trail of Bigfoot, which is told from my perspective, ends on a note that's like, you know, it's basically me saying, look, this is where I am as far as like my opinion on whether or not Bigfoot exists. But I came to this decision through my own, you know, process of actually going out in the woods and talking to all these people and being a part of some really weird events that took place over the course of a year. And that's what brought me to this point. I think there is something worth looking into in any of these subjects. And that's the biggest thing that I hope an audience takes away from them, is just like, it's fascinating. Like all of this is super intriguing and it's really exciting and it's fun to be a part of it. And hopefully, you know, like people start to realize we don't have to scoff at like the idea of UFOs and Bigfoot. You know, like you can just enjoy this without, you can enjoy it and try to find your own truth, like your own version of what you think might be the truth behind everything. And you don't have to come at these subjects with like this sneer and a, you know, making fun of everyone that's involved in it. And hopefully, like I think that there's a huge number of people that would find these subjects really interesting. I think sometimes television helps that, but I think more often than not it hurts it, because like the way television shows approach these subjects tends to be, you know, like a bunch of people out in the woods with flashlights looking for something, you know, and that's the only type of entertainment that exists about these subjects.
And they've like sort of sensationalized the idea that some of these people are sort of living in shacks down by the river, and they're sort of
right.
Like
the
woods people. I mean, that became an angle, I think, in the last 10 years that they've sort of tried to focus on because of the entertainment value to it. And unfortunately, I think it's sort of, you know, denigrated the message.
Perception is
reality. No, I mean, I know people who are into Bigfoot who are, I know an FBI agent, you know, they claimed a sighting of Bigfoot. I know, you know, biologists, field biologists. Like the stereotype of Bigfooters is like camo wearing hillbillies, and believe me, those people exist and they exist in large numbers. But that is not, you know, that is not every single person that's into the subject. And I have just as much fun, like, you know, ribbing the community, ribbing myself over this stuff as well. Like my favorite Bigfoot documentary is Bobcat Goldthwait's American Bigfoot, which is basically like an 11-minute long, just destroying
right
the Bigfoot community, and I adore it. But you know, like, so I get it, and I'm into that stuff. But I also think that there's so much more to it, and the subjects and the stories are so interesting.
You know, there it takes a certain special kind of person, and I use special liberally, that we can be self-deprecating enough that we know when we're out of our minds.
Right.
When we're able to just say, listen, I am out of my mind crazy about this.
Like, who isn't these days is the thing. Like, this is what I don't get about it. Like, the world's so crazy and we're all into so much weird stuff. Like, who is any one group to stand apart from everyone else and say, well, you're nuts? Like, you know, there's guys that go to sporting events to take their shirts off and paint letters and all right. kinds of stuff on them. And I, you know, like, I don't think that guy's any weirder than I am, and I don't think I'm any weirder than he is. So we're all equally bizarre. It's just embracing the fact that we are.
And we get a lot of we go to conventions and we get invited to a lot of events, and the horror community is a rabid community. People who love horror films, and it's a completely different breed because we do have a self-deprecating sense of humor as opposed sure. to, let's say, Trekkies. And I actually do also enjoy Star Trek. And when I say enjoy, meaning I watched enough episodes that I can wax intellectual about what Roddenberry's message was. Right. But at the same time, I'm probably a horror fan, a horror lover, because even though I like facts, I like to be able to put together a history of horror films. Yep. I cannot concentrate on this. Hopefully I'll get the terminology correct here. The speculative minutia of science fiction.
Oh, mm-hmm. right.
That's where I just sort of shake my head because it's just not my thing. And I think that that also translates to my general sort of blasé attitude when it comes to a lot of like diehard sports fans too. I like hockey. If somebody has tickets to almost any kind of game, I'll usually end up going.
Sure.
But I've never been upset enough about a horror film's ending to overturn a car and set it on fire.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge basketball fan, but I have yet to take part in a riot.
Yeah, I didn't get out of Freddy versus Jason like, you've got to be fucking kidding me.
Should have ended differently.
Yeah, this Volvo is going up in flames. Like, it just didn't occur to me that that was where rationally I needed to go to vent.
Psychologically, I wonder why you picked Volvo out of all cars.
It's the only thing that popped in my head, and I don't know why. I think because I almost feel, oh, this is a horrible tangent, but I almost
but
feel
you're gonna go there.
That there's probably, you know, I associate Volvos with right. more of like upper middle class, so it's more of an upper crust automobile.
Okay.
Yeah, I was gonna say, if you see like a Chevy, a Chevy, I don't even know car makes. Ford. If you see a Ford Escort and a Volvo sitting beside each other, you're gonna tip the Volvo. The Volvo is going over.
Right. It's just naturally gonna become the target. I mean, nobody gets out of or like a Knicks game so upset that they look at my 97 Ford Explorer and they're like, that guy deserves the brunt of my aggression.
Yeah.
Well, I guess if you're going to wear yourself out on a vehicle, you're going to take the one that each hit counts for more dollars, right?
Goddamn Volvos. God damn them.
The question becomes, though, like, what happens if like it's a Ford Escort, a Volvo, and then like a Lamborghini sitting next to each other?
Do you
just light them all on fire and walk away?
I couldn't
don't know
touch
what
the Lamborghini, though.
A part of me wants to do that just so they can see the flames in the distance.
Yeah.
You know, just sort of walking away nonchalantly. You know, like, I'm better now. This is my catharsis. I'm better now that I've set all three cars on fire. regardless of the outcome of Freddy versus Jason. But
is that movie hated now? Like, I remember I saw that movie in theaters like three times, and I was not at that point in my life. I had seen Friday the 13th and then every Freddy movie, but I wasn't like, I wouldn't at that point. I don't think I was a huge fan of either of them. And I saw the movie in theaters and I remember really enjoying it. I thought the rave scene was hilarious.
Oh, yeah. Ridiculous.
But is that like, do people hate that movie now?
It's, you know, it's weird because we see these weird shifts, especially in horror right now, like socio-political horror is really big, or horror that has to deal with like the horrors of dysfunction, like that seems to be a real focus. And because of that, I think people are applying a little more slant towards intellectual horror, and then people look back in the past as something that was more of an event film like that, and then they start hating on it. My personal opinion is I can love something that I know is absolutely stupid and ridiculous.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
And I can love it for that quality. And then you know, 15 years later, I can love something for being an intellectual approach to a dysfunctional family horror or something of that nature. But it's weird because we've got this strange sense of, like, absolutism in this country right now, where if you like this, you can't like the other thing. Like, middle of the road is not an option anymore. You know, you've got to be far left, far right. Like, you've got to be at one end of the spectrum or another. Like, you can't be sitting in the middle.
You got to pick a side.
Yeah, and I'm basically, I'm right on that dotted yellow line for the most part about a lot of things. Yeah. I don't know if I'm just non-committal. Maybe that's what it is, you know. Or I see the far sides of the spectrum as having way too much lunacy for me, and I want nothing to do with it. I don't know.
I find that if you, I don't know, you can look at something when you're younger, and then as you get older, you look at it a little differently because maybe things in your life change. And the movie stays the same, but it still appeals to you in a different way.
Sure. So, yeah, definitely.
Know, so I think that may be part of it. I never want to go, oh, I just hate this or, you know, something like that. Because what if later on I go, you know, I see something in that now that I like. So that's kind of why I don't really hate anything, you know, as far as movies.
As a filmmaker, Seth, do you also watch a lot of films?
Yeah, I mean, less so lately. And I don't know, there's something wrong with me now where I can't watch movies without picking the edit apart. And I think it's just because I literally, like, all I do every day is edit. And it's been this way for probably two straight years where I edit almost every single day. So I have a hard time of just watching. But mostly what I'm watching is documentaries or, like, really ridiculous blockbuster movies or you know, horror or whatever. I watch very few. Like, when I was a kid, I watched everything, like, old, you know, my all-time favorite movie is Lawrence of Arabia, but I love, like, Singing in the Rain and Psycho and The Shining and all that kind of stuff too. I adore Evil Dead too, but like, I watch far less over the last 2 years, and I don't know why. I also had a kid, you know, like, in the last 2 years, so that's probably playing a pretty huge role in it. Yeah, but I watch less than I should because I do love and like adore movies. I watch a lot of, like, analysis of movies. I don't watch the kind of, like, cinema sins type stuff, but I watch I watch movies where they talk about, like, you know, like, what is it? There's what is it, Cinema Tyler? There's some sort of YouTube channel where this guy just analyzes, like, what works about movies, and that's the kind of stuff that I love. I don't really necessarily want to sit and pick stuff apart because I do that enough with my own work all day, every day.
Yeah.
So I like to really, like, focus in on what works about a lot of different films that I watched as a kid. I mean, that was for years, that was all I did, was sit in my room and watch movies. And this was, like, the guys that Zach Palmisano, who shoots my movies, and then Jason Udis, who's we call him our production manager, which he is definitely that, but he also is our sound recordist and does about a million other jobs on each movie. But those two dudes I grew up with, and this was what we always wanted to do, was make movies. So this was kind of, you know, it's a lifelong thing. I just don't think any of us ever thought we would be making documentaries about the paranormal and cryptids. You know, like, it's a bizarre thing to wake up one day and be like, oh, I'm, you know, like, this is my career now. I'm making movies about things everyone else thinks, normal people think, are absolutely ridiculous. But yes, I the short answer is yes, I love movies. I just don't watch enough of them.
What's the last thing in your memory? We ask a lot of people this simply because we do speak to a lot of filmmakers, a lot of directors, and a lot of writers. And it seems that we do sort of get bogged down and mired in the idea of what craft is, especially when we end up watching films. For us as people who work in film ourselves and also as reviewers, it's difficult to watch a film and sort of get lost in the escapism of it now. So I understand that completely. What's the last thing that you saw that might have rejuvenated your interest or just really just caught you? Just something that really grabbed you?
Well, A Touch of Evil. I watch it, like, once every couple of years. And I watched it recently, and I, for some reason, that opening, the crazy, like, oneer that opens the movie with Charlton Heston in the car and the bomb in the car, like, that that never fails to wow me, but this was like seeing it for the first time again or something. It was a very surreal experience, mm-hmm. like watching that movie. And I adore that movie, probably more so than Citizen Kane. I actually do love Citizen Kane, but I think Touch of Evil I might respond to a little more. But it was probably that. Like, strangely enough, I saw Aquaman in theaters and had a very powerful reaction to that movie, which is probably not something most people are saying. But it was such a pure kind of comic book movie, and I'm a big time comic book fan, especially mm-hmm. DC. Like I've loved DC comics all my life, and so to watch that movie had a cool. I had a cool like geek reaction to that, which I haven't had that reaction to any comic book movie in the last, like, I don't know, however long it's been since The Dark Knight came out. Like, it was that kind of thing for me where I got super into that. Before that, it was probably Big Trouble in Little China, because it's probably one of my top like five favorite movies ever made, and I watch it every year. And yeah, I mean, like, if we start going down this rabbit hole, I'll talk about every movie. Like, my bookshelf, I'm looking at my bookshelves right now, and it's just lined with those like books about the making of movies. So I've got like for Christmas this year, I got the Close Encounters retrospective and Jaws Memories and Planet of the Apes Behind the Scenes and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I grew up on, my mom raised me on two things, Hammer horror, especially the Christopher Lee Dracula movies, and Ray Harryhausen.
Oh, nice.
So like those two things played a huge role in my upbringing, I guess, as a kid. Like, that was my cinema. Like, those were the things that I loved and adored. So it kind of makes sense, I guess, that I'm making movies about monsters. It's just not the type of monsters I would have predicted as a kid who was trying to figure out how to do stop motion with my Legos.
But, you know, we are in this sort of unspoken club, though. A lot of us who were exposed to those kinds of movies, especially the Hammer films and a lot of Harryhausen stuff, that as we grow older, these interests sort of started to converge, strangely enough, about, you know, and it might be the paranormal. It might be the fact that when we were watching this stuff and we were children, there was this belief in the reality of it. Even though we knew it was a film, it was like we were watching some sort of histrionic context, you know, that there was something else there, and it helped us give in to the idea of believing in the images.
This is the type of conversation I never get to have anymore either. Like, the podcasts I do typically are like the interview. They're always just about like, tell us your scary story kind of stuff. And this is my next question.
Damn it.
Yeah. This is the stuff I love, though. Like, just talking about movies and how movies impacted our lives and like what we're doing now and stuff like that. Like, I've put so much of what I grew up on into the last few movies we've made. I wasn't really comfortable doing that until after we finished Mothman. And then, because Mothman's still very much like a traditional sort of documentary. And then when we got to Invasion on Chestnut Ridge, I was like, you know what? I'm all in. I'm just going to make like a crazy, like 80s style VHS horror movie that's secretly a documentary about the paranormal. And then after that, I did the Flatwoods Monster, which was basically one big homage to Harryhausen, including like we built a 15-foot tall Flatwoods Monster replica to put in that movie, and there's everything in that. There's stop motion in that movie. There's really hilariously silly green screen like Ed Wood style stuff in that movie with like a really great CG Flatwoods Monster chasing someone to a car after they've thrown up. And that's probably been the most exciting thing for me over the last like two to three years, and it's how I'm really like, it was the point where I realized I could basically do whatever I wanted because there are movies. Like that has been the most exciting thing for me. Like the Terror in the Sky is the one I was telling you about that we filmed in Illinois. Mm-hmm. Like that is kind of like a love letter to Spielberg visually. Like we set out to kind of capture that like Close Encounters Midwest look. Like it's also got some weird like North by Northwest stuff going on, which I'm not sure why I kept coming back to North by Northwest. But when I was talking to the director of photography, I kept showing him pictures of North by Northwest. And I was like, I don't know why I'm coming back to this so much, but this is like the thing I keep thinking of. So, yeah, that is like you asked about like what reinvigorated, you know, my love for film or whatever, right. But this is what's reinvigorated like my love for making film. It's been like really getting to dive into telling stories the way I want to do it, and being able to consciously, after the fact, most of the time, see where the influences are coming from.
Well, I think what you're able to do too is you're able to make films. Even though these are documentaries, they feel like films. And the idea that you've been able to take some pretty disparate subjects, because when we're looking at cryptids, we're looking at the paranormal. I mean, this is a broad spectrum. It really is. Yeah. And to be able to bounce around it but sort of still have that zeal is something that you don't see that often. I've actually posted quite a few times just about the fact that I actually love that you guys are doing this. It's not just like random cockstroking here. It's like, seriously, like whenever I get a press release about something you guys are doing, I'm like, these are people that are actually making films for me, because these are topics that I actually really enjoy. And I also like the fact too that you can tell that it's and I'm going to try to put this as politely as possible for the people who are doing it the other way. You are filmmakers making films about these subjects. There's a consistent level of production that often will fall by the wayside unless it's something that's geared towards network television. If that makes sense.
No, it's 100% true. Like there's a lot of people who are passionate about these subjects who are making movies, but they're not making them as filmmakers. And I don't know if this is what you were meaning exactly, but like I've seen that a lot, is like the filmmaking side of the movies is actually like secondary to their love for the subjects.
Yeah.
And when that happens, I think the quality of it suffers drastically, and you end up with something that, you know, looks pretty bad. Like there's a lot of very lower rung paranormal content out there, and that's fine. Like I did that for the first bunch of movies, and some people would argue I'm still doing it today. So like that's a great place to start. It's just at some point people have to start investing serious time into figuring out how to better themselves as a filmmaker, and that's where like the men are separated from the boys or whatever, because it's so much work that goes into this, and we're talking 5 years of consistently making two movies a year is where we're at. I can hardly speak right now, but we've, you know, two movies per year since 2015. And then last year I was like, well, that's not enough. I'm also going to throw in a Verite style miniseries each year. So like, then we started doing On the Trail Of, which, you know, like you said, the films are cinematic. Like that is 100% our approach is to make them as cinematic as possible. On the Trail Of is fun for me because it's not. Like, to me, it's not necessarily cinematic at all. It's more of that Verite style, you know, like just shoot it as it happens kind of thing.
Right.
And that's been a lot of fun for me because it's completely different from the process of making the films, you know, where every single shot is kind of like planned out and your interviews are lit and you're, you know, backlighting stuff. And then there's like On the Trail Of, where I am alone with my A7S and I just plop it down in front of someone and they talk to my camera. You know, that for me has been a blast because it's just so different from the normal process of making our movies.
Now, how will On the Trail Of be released? Because it's being released episodically, correct?
So, yeah, I mean, it actually came out Friday, but it's episodic, 6-episode miniseries on Vimeo On Demand, VidiSpace, and on DVD. And then on Amazon, it's still episodic, but we condensed the episodes into two movies. So movie one is it's two storylines. So the first three episodes, episodes 1 through 3, form a story called The Legend, and that just walks you through the whole history of the subject. And then episodes 4 through 6 are called The Search. And that's much more about actual investigating and going out in the woods and experiencing things with people who are looking for Bigfoot. So it's still done somewhat within the context of the history of the community, but it's, or the subject, but it's not, it's much more focused on the investigative side of things. And so we did that because we're independent, completely independent. Like, we don't even have a distributor, for most of our stuff anymore. We have had a good experience with distribution as far as Terror Films is concerned, but, for now, I'm enjoying self-distributing them, and we're actually having probably an equal amount or more success that way. So with this one, we are self-distributing it, and because of that, we discovered in the last year a lot of what we do, we learn through trial and error. And you know, we had discovered that independent episodic content does terrible on any platform I can get it on. So even though I love this episodic style of storytelling that we're using, we decided to do this like condensed movie style version for Amazon, and it's worked out. It's both movies are in the top 100, all of the top 100 best-selling new releases right now. So I think movie one is at like 50 last time I checked, as in like it's literally it passed some Keanu Reeves movie yesterday, which was weird. Nice. But yeah, they're both in that top 100 best-selling new releases, so I was glad to see at least they're finding an audience, and the reviews have been ridiculously great. Like, movie one has 50 reviews, and I think there's only like 1 2-star review, and everything else is 4 stars.
Yeah, it's interesting where we're at as far as moviegoers. It's interesting, entertainment and how entertainment is digested now is changing. You know, with the advent of the binge approach to episodic content, I don't know if people know how to watch episodic content anymore. It seems like we're sort of in this flux of being able to watch something and have it you know, given to us incrementally. And the idea of being able to watch 15 to 18, 20 plus hours of content at the same time. And I've even read a lot to the idea of full-length feature films and their length taking a huge shift, where filmmakers are looking at the three-hour movie as being a more viable concept than the hour and 50-minute movie. And that was always so frowned upon in the past, unless we, we go back to the, you know, the 40s and 50s, and then, you know, we had intermissions, you know, so.
Sure. Yeah, we showed a 2-hour cut of On the Trail of Bigfoot at the premiere, and I was terrified, because I've never, our movies are actually pretty short, like, traditionally, I think there's a ceiling that like a general audience, and that's who I'm, you know, we make movies for, but I think there's like a ceiling to what a general audience can sit through when you're talking about, you know, stories about werewolves and Bigfoot. That's a completely different subject.
There's a fetishist story in there somewhere.
That's probably the adult cut of this movie.
Yeah, I think there's a limit to what they can sit through. So, like, you know, like, traditionally, our movies hit, like, about an hour and 5 minutes, an hour and 10 minutes, and we're out. And On the Trail of Bigfoot is close to 3 hours long total. So we showed a 2-hour cut where I had narrowed it down to, like, 4 of the 6 episodes. And I was shocked. Like, the entire 500-strong audience was in there when I came in after it had ended, because I never sit in to watch my own stuff because I just pick it apart. And I went in afterward and everyone was there, and there's this like ridiculous applause. I was so relieved with that fact, because my biggest concern about it was that, you know, it's a huge chunk of time. Like, that's a big commitment by an audience, especially when they're actually sitting in a theater being expected to, you know, sit through through 2 hours of me running through the woods with Bigfooters.
Now, and this is probably sort of goes back to more of the traditional line of questioning, but this is something that has interested me, because when I think about the paranormal, when I think about cryptids, the stuff that interests me is the stuff that passes strange, the stuff that goes so far beyond the idea of being ridiculous that it almost becomes hyper-believable. You know, why exactly would we make up something as absolutely ludicrous is this? It adds that level of believability to me. So there are things that, for example, like the Brave Road Beast is of interest to me because the concept of werewolves, even amongst cryptids, seems to be a little far-flung, and I like that. I also like things that have sort of inserted themselves into, like, late-night AM lore culture. Mel's Hole, for example, which was a story that run rampant through the annals of Coast to Coast AM for years. So as far as stories like that, especially with the idea that you guys are getting a little more prolific and not just doing the full-length stuff but also doing episodic content, is there been anything that really passes that strange mark that you've sort of got your eye on right now?
Not that I can immediately talk about, because we are working on something that I can't directly speak. And it's something that's been – there's been other films made about it. But we're actually working on something that was just featured in a film recently that we want to dive into as part of On the Trail of UFOs, which is our next On the Trail of miniseries, which starts shooting probably in the next like month or two.
Okay.
But there's some it's Skinwalker. Like we're gonna get into like the Skinwalker Ranch stuff.
Yeah, I had an inkling. Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know yet in what capacity. And, you know, like there's a lot of things that could happen there that would turn me away from doing that. Like right. If I can't get the right people involved and I can't get the right people to step in front of the camera, it would be something we'd have to skip. But it is something like that's such a weird situation. And some of the stories are so bizarre that it like you said, it almost becomes hyper believable, because why would the people make it up that, you know, like why did the original why would they make that up, the original ranch owners, and the stories about, like, you know, the cattle that went missing and then turned up in that trailer, like,
so many
bizarre little side stories to that. And in a way, like, it really reminds me of our Chestnut Ridge movie, where you've got, you know, this one location where over the course of decades, you've had one strange thing after the next happen, and it only gets weirder. Like more recently, they've had these sightings of this some sort of creature with no head, with like eyes in its chest, that was seen by a police officer, and like that's another movie where we could easily go back and make a like 200 sequels if that first movie had ever actually made any money, which it didn't. But that's another one that's sort of like that.
Well, sort of has baffled me about the film approach to the Skinwalker stories is that there's so many stories there that in essence lend itself to great fantastic storytelling, but it seems whenever we get an interpretation of it, it's usually in vignette form, very small, where they don't focus on a lot of these strange details, or they give us the stuff that we've heard a million
literally
times.
Literally echoing, you were echoing word for word something I just said this morning, because we were talking about Skinwalker on my podcast, and I said what bugs me about it is there's been so much done about it, and yet I feel like I know nothing about it, because these people go off on all these tangents and side stories about things that really don't have any bearing on the immediate story. I feel like I don't understand the history of that ranch from start to finish. You know, like in a way it reminds me of Mothman. Like I knew all about the Mothman case, but I had not seen a film or a TV show that really boiled that story down to that one 1966, 1967 time period and took you chronologically through that.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. Like that was why we set out to make our movie the way we did. And this just reminds me of that. Like there's so much to it and there's so many fascinating stories. But we always end up in these weird, like I don't want to bash anyone else's movie or anything. I just feel like there's some huge missed opportunities with that story.
Yeah, there's been a lot of blurred focus when it comes to the Skinwalker stories, and stuff where it seems that they want to take details that really reinforce certain aspects of ufology, and, mm-hmm. and it's strange that they pick those details, because then it just seems like another story. It seems right. like another collection of events, when in all actuality, some of the key figures that were players in this, and not to mention the people that were on the ranch itself, I mean, this should have been a national story of interest.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how it got. I don't know how it is what it is today. Like, the government was involved in investigating it. You know, like, this is a big deal stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yet,
it in a lot of ways, it's like just one of those side stories in the paranormal world. I don't even feel like it's a mainstream, you know, very well known story. But again, like, for me, it's all about those the stories, like, chronologically going through what happened, how that family was impacted by it, what happened to them while they were there. I feel like I've only heard bits and pieces here and there, and don't know the entire story from start to finish.
And I think that's the general overview that we have of that particular story, is something where it comes across as extremely disjointed. We get strange details. We don't even really get the details that are impactful. We get these strange details that make it seem ancillary and peripheral. And then when you get to a point where, like, you read the book, and then it's sort of what I call, like, a pant shitter. You know, you read the book and you're like, why in the world haven't we been, you know, introduced to this?
Quote. That should be your pull quote for the reprint. It could be right on the cover.
That. Yeah, this is a real life pant shitter. So where can people, we talked about Amazon, as far as On the Trail of, it looks like it's pretty accessible right now. You said it came out Friday. Yeah. Where can people also find the back catalog of Small Town Monsters films?
Yeah, I mean, all of our movies are available on Amazon, and the bulk of them right now are free on Amazon Prime. So if you're a subscriber, you can watch them on there. But there are three of them: Boggy Creek Monster, The Mothman of Point Pleasant, and Invasion on Chestnut Ridge are on a lot of different platforms. They're distributed through Terror Films, so those are on, like, iTunes and Google Play, and, you know, all those different avenues. Tubi TV has a few of them, and then but yeah, the biggest thing is, like, Amazon, Vimeo on demand. There's a platform called VidiSpace that's super cool for paranormal content. And DVD through smalltownmonsters.com.
And when we get into these conversations, I always feel like we need to change the format of the show from an hour to, like, 2 or 3 hours. Especially when we start talking about filmmaking and we get into these subjects that normally we don't really get to hit upon that much.
Yeah, well, for me, the filmmaking and film is the thing I don't get to hit upon. So it's great. Like, anytime I get to actually talk about something other than, like, my scary side stories, I'm happy to have the opportunity to do that.
I have a question. Now, you did a Boggy Creek Monster movie, so mm-hmm. I guess you were a fan of the original?
I mean, I didn't grow up with it or anything, but it was a movie that I came to really appreciate and enjoy after or during the making of our movie, for sure.
Okay. There's a the movie's being restored right now. I don't know if you do you know about that?
Yeah, she actually just texted me this morning. I'm trying to help with the distribution schedule and how they're handling that stuff. But yeah, Charles Pierce's daughter is the movie's fully restored. I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous. She really did a great job on that. So yeah, that's supposed to be out later this year, but I'm not sure yet what the distribution deal is that they're going for.
I think a friend of mine is loaning a TV spot for that.
So, awesome. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool.
Well, we definitely need to have you back on, Seth.
Yes.
And any time that you have something new in the pipeline, by all means, reach out to us. And we'd love to have you back on, not only just to discuss film, but, you know, things that you have that are, you know, coming up in the world of Small Town Monsters. Cool. Now, is there a Twitter, Facebook?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Twitter is at Small Town Monsters. I think it's like super complicated. It might be like small_town_monsters. Anyway, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all that stuff. And then smalltownmonsters.com or onthetrailof.tv.
Cool.
Do you have a few minutes off the air for us, Seth?
Yeah, for sure.
Right. Again, we want to thank you for being on tonight. We had a blast. I definitely encourage people to go look for any of the films that are currently out, and especially what we talked about. It looks like we've got some really cool things sort of looming on the horizon. Again, this is Ash Hamilton. You can reach us through horror-fix.com, Night Terrors Podcast on iTunes, and a bunch of other resources. Thanks so much, everybody. Have a great night.
Thank you.